But I want to start off with three quotations. The first was a poem, which everyone knows, called The Dugout. And I think just for safety, in order while I put my feet under me, Professor Raymond, you could read The Dugout for us, please.
This is stand two.
Yes, of course, stand two.
Stand two. Good Friday morning, 22nd of April, 1916. I'd been on duty from 2 till 4. I went and stared at the dugout door. Down in the frost I heard them snore. Stand to. Someone grunted and swore. Dawn was misty. The skies were still. Larks were singing, discordant, shrill. They seemed happy, but I felt ill. Deep in water I splashed my way up to the trench to our bogged front line. Rain had fallen the whole damn night. O Jesus, send me a wound today, and I'll believe in your bread and wine, and get my bloody old sins washed white.
Now, the second quotation follows on, because that poem, as we know, Stand To, was composed on Good Friday, 1916. And he followed it up with a poem. With a memoir, in which the speaker, is George Sherston, and he is speaking on Easter Sunday morning, and this is how George Sherston saw things on that morning of Easter morn. Back in the main trench, I stood on the fire step to watch the sky whitening, sad and stricken. The country emerged. I could see the ruined village below the hill and the leafless trees that whitened dull.
That waited dull. Like centuries.
I've got to stop there, like centuries. Because I remember the first time I read that, I thought, all those central pines. Imagine, as he looked across, those central pines in a happier time. And now he's looking at these trees in a wall area, like centuries. Down in the crater, the dead water took the leaning.
Took a dull gleam.
So I think you
no, no, you're doing very well,
please.
Johnson. Down in the craters, the dead water took a dull gleam from the sky. I stared at the tangles of wire and the leaning posts, and there seemed no sort of comfort left in life. Here I was, staring across at the enemy I had never seen. Somewhere out of sight, beyond the splintered treetops of hidden wood, a bird had begun to sing. Without knowing why, I remembered that it was Easter Sunday. Standing in the dismal ditch, I could find no consolation in the thought that Christ was risen. I sploshed back to the dugout to call the others up for Stand Two.
I think that's a remarkable piece of writing there. Remarkable piece of writing. But I want to go on to my third extract immediately, which is Easter Day, as described by Siegfried himself, as opposed to George Sherston.
It is from his diary, 23rd of April, 1916, Easter Day. Out of trenches yesterday. The last 2 days have been wet and horrid. Yesterday evening, the trees looked like ashen smoke rising from the rain-swept hills. Today, as I rolled along in the motor bus from Mericourt to Flexecourt, everything was golden and April's end green trees and apple blossom nearly out. I have done 18 days in the trenches, coming away from it all to find the world outside rarely acknowledging the arrival of spring. Oh, it was a blessed thing, the renewal of green grass and young leaves, People going to church on Easter morning, it was like coming back to life. It was to feel how much there was to regain.
Right, so now we've got two, what might appear conflicting accounts. One of hope and the other of despair. With George Hurston in the trench and Siegfried on the bus, suddenly realizing that there was so much to regain. So what that passage tells us is that it's about resurrection. It's about resurrection. And in fact, they are not conflicting accounts, but one is the extension of the other, the flip side of the other. The trench in which George Thurston stood and could find no consolation. And I think this is very clever of Siegfried. He says, I could find no consolation in the thought that Christ was risen. He doesn't deny the resurrection. He said, I had, in the thought of it, I had no consolation. George Hurston is in his grave, is in his trench. But Siegfried is in the bus. He's come out of the trench. He's come to resurrection. He's come from darkness to the trench, into the light of the French morning. He's come from the winter, the water under his feet, into all the indications of spring around him. It was like coming back to life again. It's like coming back to life again, and I realized how much there was to regain. I want to go on very quickly, a good many years, to the 19th of April 1957, again Easter Day. And it's a wonderful, it's a poem which...
Can you read, John?
Yeah, I'm not saying I can do it, I'll do my best. No comfort came until I looked for light beyond the darkened thickets of my brain. With nothingness I strove, an inward sight, no omen but oblivion could obtain. He spoke, he held my spirit in his hands. Through prayer, my password from the gloom was given. This Eastertide, absolved, in strength I stand. Feet firm upon the ground, my heart in heaven. Now, really what we would like to think about is how Siegfried came from 1916. Just in the trench, Siegfried in the bus, and this Eastertide 1957. My feet firm upon the ground, my heart in heaven. Exactly what he said to Father Philip. He was in heaven, and he brought heaven with him. In his introduction to a marvellous work that he did, an octave. Charles Causley, the editor, received a letter from Siegfried in May 1966. Sassoon said, about the poems in this volume, I've always been a religious poet. Actually, he says something more than that. Again, very precise. I've always been a religious poet in intention. And the poems here are my testimony of established faith. It's not that there are no doubts or uncertainties anymore, or even a searching anymore. He's experienced the fulfillment of his search. He's come to the door. he came here, and this was the doorway he did create for heaven for him. And I let me understand that. I've always been, by intention, the religious poet. So even go back to his earlier poems, he was, his intent was, his concern was, to express his religious feelings, explain his religious speech. Now, as we say, there's no doubt that of Siegfried's concern for this matter of pilgrimage and resurrection fulfillment. And that is reflected in something else, another recurring theme. I think I'm right in saying this, that Sassoon's a Siegfried's favourite season of the year was spring. If you go through his poems, the number of times it's spring, and suddenly his poems take off again. Maybe done, and then suddenly another spring, and up he comes again. And all this time is because he is experiencing resurrection. He's experiencing renewal. Now, we can regard Siegfried really as a poet of resurrection. Now, it's not easy to define what a religious poet is. It is easier to, it is harder to define a Christian poet. It is easier for us to define a Christian poet than a religious poet, because the word religion has such a wide category. And in today's culture of confusion, I think it is very important to actually claim Siegfried as a Christian poet. That is not to denigrate other poets in other religions and other faiths, but I think it's important for us to understand that Siegfried was a Christian. Now, it's much easier to actually define other kinds of poets. For example, W. H. Auden has been described as an industrial poet because his poems are full of canals and pylons and trains and all that paraphernalia of an industrial society. And it's easy for us to identify because we can see the pilot. We can read about the canal in his work. But what do you do with a religious poet, with a Christian poet? It's very difficult. But I'm going to just pick up some examples where I think proves that we can actually claim Sassoon as a Christian poet, both by his upbringing. And one of the things that impresses me enormously is how deeply ingrained his early Christian teaching was. He was fluent in life and in the atmosphere, you know, what we call the suggestion behind the words. He was well into that as a child. He was brought up in that kind of home, you know, brought up on ancient and modern. Of course, there is a story told that you can always tell a public school boy. Because, particularly at funerals, because he's the only one who can sing hymns without using the book. But he knows it's ingrained in him. And it was ingrained in Siegfried. I always feel when I'm reading it, he really takes me into the suggestion behind the word, his religious poetry. Now, in his middle years, when he was very confused, I still think we should say he was a confused pilgrim. He wasn't a confused man, he was a confused pilgrim. He was still on his search. Through all the ups and downs and diminishments of his life, his midlife, you have this feeling that Sassoon is on his pilgrimage. He's not giving it up. As he says in Lent Illuminations, there were many byways. Many byways. Many illusions. Many altars that ultimately he left, but throughout it all he never forgot that he was a pilgrim. And this awareness of being a pilgrim, I think, classifies him, for me anyway, as a Christian poet. And then, of course, we come to that wonderful period in his life when he reached his old age, and he found the most wonderful time, wonderful consolations here at Downside and in the Christian faith and through the Catholic Church. Now, my next poem is almost my favourite, almost, because it explains what kind of Christian poet and what Siegfried was, and and what happened to him when he came to this faith, when he found it, and he called it, which is rather ironic to be self-sufficient to us, not pre-insufficient today, but anyway, the poem is my first, this is it, self-sufficient. Would you like to read this?
I'm sure you can do
no,
it.
No, I don't wish you would just read it. I can get on to the next page.
God, on the gloom, where toward I pray? You send no sign, no doubt redeeming ray, nor manifest for this unwisdomed one the faith that blessed his pilgrim path begun. O purpose of my prayer, breath of my being, your inward light I share through sightless seeing. Your love can but be told beyond blind thought that knows your peace enfold believement brought.
Now that to me identifies Siegfried as a Christian poet. It was sightless seeing, as the man in the blind man in the New Testament says and testifies, whereas I was blind, now I can see. And we say that also, where he was blind, now he can see. And the joy, they call it, of sightless seeing. And all that is brought about by a thing called faith in a person dead. I mean, these are very fundamental things. I mean, they may not be interesting. But to me, I think we have to get back to certain bricks upon which faith and Sassoon's religious experience have been built. And he identifies God as that on the gloom. But he's there, he knows he's there, with gloom. And he writes self-sufficient in order to underline, in order to emphasize that. And he believed it was possible, as we do in a Christian faith, to believe that it is possible for the creature to have a relationship and knowledge of the Creator. And Siegfried's work really expands and explores that relationship between the pilgrim and God. I find him particularly moving in this regard, and upper sight. So I want to come back and talk about reclaiming Sassoon. Because in a way, Sassoon's relevance does not lie, I say this blindly, does not rely, his pertinence to our age does no longer lie in his war poems. I mean, they're there as signals, they're there as warnings, they're there as system, and they're there for no intrinsic value. But to me, to rediscover Siegfried is to rediscover this idea of self-sufficient. I've been very interested in watching Professor Dawkins on the enemies of reason. And by association, we must be including in that Siegfried Sassoon as a poet. Because there are so many words and phrases used in Christian faith, and Siegfried himself used them, that just don't make sense. I mean, what does sightless mean? And it's a meaningless thing, Professor Dawkins. This is to be an enemy of reason. But there are things beyond blind sense, Siegfried says. And he makes us feel that it is possible, I mean, this is what he's taught me, that there is knowledge beyond knowledge. To understand that which passeth understanding. This is the language that Siegfried deals in. You see that oxymorons on us, but there they are for us, and he puts right and he believes in them. Now, he is able to do that because he has crossed the boundary. He's crossed the boundary where he's no longer walking by sight, but by faith. He's no longer tied up in this world where things are seen, but he's engaged with things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. And that is why Siegfried is always talking about, he may have his feet going by the ground, but my heart is in heaven. And that is why it was so moving the way that Philip described it. And I think we need to reclaim this idea that man does not live by bread. That we are capable of seeing things beyond sight, of understanding things that pass understanding, and to know the love of God. I mean, that is what the body of Sassoon's work is really all about. And I know, I can say with assurance that if he were here today, he would be saying Amen in a very big way. So I think part of our work is, to the extent of sharing this, a re-establishing of Siegfried and a discovery of Siegfried as a truly great Christian poet. Now I just want to move on from there, very quickly, to the next poem, which I think, I don't know how to describe it, it's Siegfried at his cheapest. Because he takes on this idea of a world that is only that which you see. He takes on the intellectual approach to life. And again, it touches the boundary between winter and spring. One winter's end, I much bemused my head in tasked attempts to drive it up to date with what the undelighting moderns thought forecasting human fate. And then, with nothing new to say, and no belief or unbelief, came in its old unintellectual way the first real day of spring. That really is cheeky. I mean, that's a cheeky poem there, you know. And you get the essence of what Sue is saying. Came in its old unintellectual way the first real day of spring. And I think a Christian poet is someone who is surprised by joy, as we would say. Someone who can look at the world around him, nature, and can receive messages. Things happening in his life, he's open to experience. And he puts down, you know, the way in which that may be the winter, but this is the spring. And the spring does not come because of intellectuals. It doesn't come in an intellectual way. This is not to be the enemy of reason. This is to be faithful, I think, to the Christian revelation, about which Sassoon was so committed. So I hope you remember, if you've read it, as you probably will, that little poem is a cheeky poem. And much that you read Sassoon is really being very cheeky. And unlike other poets, Sassoon, if he's got to speak, he does speak with his tongue in his own cheek and not in somebody else's. Which so very often with other poets. This sight of seeing, it reminds me of something that is very difficult to explain to other people, very difficult to convince other people of. But I think about Sebastian Flight in Brideshead Revisited, where he's having a coffee and a conversation with Charles Ryder after Mass on a Sunday. Ryder didn't go. And he starts asking Sebastian all these odd questions about this, that and the other. Sebastian's reading his newspaper and doesn't really want to go into it, and Charles is persistent. And Sebastian says to Charles Ryder, "My dear Charles, if you can't see, you can't see." Which sounds very final, but something has got to happen to enable you to see. That's Siegfried's point. You know, and that's how I understand the poem Accord, for example. Something must happen in order for you to see, Siegfried says. Now, I want just Steph's point, next point, it's the one by Henry Bourne. And can you read this?
Yes. August 1924, I think. Above the voiceful windings of a river, an old green slab of simply graven stone shuns notice, overshadowed by a yew. Here Vaughan lies dead, whose name flows on forever, through pastures of the spirit washed with dew, and starlit with eternities unknown. Here sleeps the silurist, the loved physician, the face that left no portraiture behind, the skull that housed white angels and had vision of daybreak through the gateways of the mind. Here faith and mercy, wisdom and humility, whose influence shall prevail forevermore, shine, and this lowly grave tells heaven's tranquility, and here stand I, a suppliant at the door.
A suppliant at the door, for the door marks a boundary. And she soon wants to go through the door into the fullness of experience. Now, I think this is contemporary writing. I think this is about our society. And I think we hold a treasure in Sassoon that should be shared. But he is standing as a suppliant at the door. I'm going to move on quickly. I'd like to read a chord.
On stillness came a chord, while I, the instrument, knew long withheld reward. Gradual the glory went, vibrating on and on, toward harmony unheard, till dark where Sanctus shone, lost once a living word. But in me yet abode the given grace, though gone, the love, the lifted load, the answered orison.
Sassoon, this poet, was an instrument when he opened up. He opened up to amazing themes and influences, and he describes the work of the poet, the calling of the poet, as being an instrument. Not a cause, but an instrument. And as we read Siegfried, and continue to read in sequences and other of his religious poetry, you get this impression of the music of the spheres. You hear a pure instrument, a note coming from him, that goes on and on and on, because he's dealing his work with eternal things. Not things that are for today, but things that are forever. And we are talking about him now. His work is going on, because he's opened himself up. He sees, as a poet, that he is an instrument. But very quickly, I would say that the other thing about the Christian poet is his observation of nature, which is what he felt with Henry Vaughan, that these metaphysical poets, and in ways Sassoon was a metaphysical poet, I don't think he was of that quality, but he was someone who could respond to nature in the manner of Henry Vaughan and George Herbert, two great Welshmen, by the way, the poet. And I'm going to try and read this poem, because myself at the time. It's called Another Spring. Age itself, disposed to lose his hold on life, looks down at winter's ending, winter again, and perceives continuance in some crinkled primrose leaves. You know, Siegfried had a bit of a thing for primroses. He used to flirt a bit with roses and occasional lark and a daffodil, but primrose is the sumac flower, some crinkled primrose leaves. A noise of nesting rooks in tangled trees. Stillness. No, you have to read this, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Can you give it to me? Yeah. No, I didn't have it.
I put it out very big, but I said I'll be able to contact.
Another spring. Aged self, disposed to lose his hold on life, looks down at winter's ending and perceives continuance in some crinkled primrose leaves. A noise of nesting rooks in tangled trees. Stillness inbreathed, expectant. Shadows that bring cloud castle thoughts from downland distances. Eyes, ears are old, but not the sense of spring. Look, listen, live. Some inward watcher warns. Absorb this moment's meaning and be wise with hearts whom the first primrose purifies.
I mean, that is so beautifully expressed, so deeply felt, and so pertinent to a man and woman's inner life. This is the life, not only of the spirit, but this is life in the spirit. And quickly on to the Arbor Vitae. So.
Arbor Vitae, 1959, I think. For grace in me divined, this metaphor I find, a tree, how can that be? This tree all winter through found no green work to do, no life therein ran rife. But with an awoken year, what surge of sap is here, what flood in branch and bud? So grace in me can hide, be darkened and denied, then once again vesture my every vein.
That poem is a poem not of resurrection, but of renewal. And one of the things that really entrances me about St. Francis is the way in which all his ups and downs, with all the wilderness, and he had a wilderness experience, even after he had been accepted in the church, he had problems. And it seemed that there was no grace in him, that everything had died down. And he wrote to the abbess of Sternbrook to say that that poem marked the end of his first year of conversion enthusiasm. You know, you can all start well, but can you continue well? And simply did continue. Because, as he says, in there the tree may look barren. It may look as if it has no life in it. That's what happens in nature. You know, it all leaves, starts creeping, and you think it's all, there's no life in it. And then suddenly comes spring, and the branches and the buds and everything comes out. And that is Siegfried's experience. And however low he went, he may have been, he may have been knocked down, but he was never knocked out. Never. Because there was this resurgence in him, in his writing. Now I'm going to end, we're going to put the letter. I'm just going to just go on to Lenten Illuminations.
Okay.
This is the third element in Lenten Illuminations.
This then brought our new making, much emotional stress, call it conversion, but the word can't cover such good. It was like being in love with ambient blessedness, in love with life transformed, life breathed afresh, though yet half understood. There had been many byways for the frustrate brain, all leading to illusions lost and shrines forsaken. One road before us now, one guidance for our gain, one morning light, whatever the world's weather, wherein wide-eyed to waken.
heard anything better than ambient blessings. I mean, it's stunning. Ambient blessings. And this poem ends exactly where I began. It's with the eyes wide open. The eyes wide open. And that, if I may suggest to you, is the joy of psychosis. I'm sorry to have been happy and ragged, but I really like it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.